Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 208th video cast, 198th podcast for the week ending October 12th, 2023. Great to be home this week. We had 9 days in Portugal, and just to round out the last few days and get you caught up to speed before we get down to business here, we had the pleasure to be invited to the royal wedding in Portugal last weekend, which was pretty exciting. I mean, more exciting for my wife than it was for me, honestly. I was more interested in the golf courses. But nonetheless, this was the Duke and Duchess of Braganza at the Palace of Mafra. So it was really a special event. We got picked up by local media. I guess the prophet is never a prophet in his own land. TVI Oficial took a picture of us. And then Caitlin, of course, got all the press in Caras, which is apparently the People magazine of Portugal. So there's my lovely wife in her blue dress. This was the engagement party on, not the engagement party, the rehearsal dinner on Friday night before the wedding at the palace in Qashqai, I believe. I mean, we were in Sintra, but Sintra, Qashqai, and Estoril are all together, so they're literally like 5 minutes apart. I think this is Qashqai. And then, let's see here, just quickly. This was in the rehearsal dinner, which was absolutely amazing. Met some great folks there. This was before the wedding at Mafra, and then in the wedding. And then that's the royal couple there. Really nice couple, by the way. They were very, very friendly during the rehearsal dinner. Obviously, on the main day, we didn't get to talk to them. And then this was the party afterwards. So congratulations to them. What a beautiful day, or 2 days, rather. And then the day before, we got to go out to the track in Estoril and see some of these incredible cars. That was the Aston Martin from the James Bond movie everyone knows. I think that's a 62 or 63. And then Lotus, they had all these classic cars there. I'm a huge Lotus fan, had one many years ago now. Was the most fun you'll ever have driving an automobile. I think they're coming out with some new ones in the US, so that might be interesting. And watched a few races, was just a great, great experience. All right, on to it. First, wanna thank Sagarika Jazangani for including me in her article on Bloomberg. This was over the weekend when everyone was, you know, the Hamas had attacked Israel. Everyone was thinking that the futures were going to crash and, well, actually futures were down, but that the markets were going to crash and oil was going to go to 120. And my quote was, you know, in the short term, we may see a little bit of volatility, but when you step back and look company by company as to whether regional conflict will affect their earnings power, in most cases, the answer is no. It's an unfortunate circumstance, but will have little to no impact on aggregate earnings power. And we'll leave it at that. That proved to be true. Reuters, this is about the IPO of Birkenstock yesterday, thanks to Chibuke Ogu and Manya Sayani and Niket Nishant, excuse me, for having me in that article. There we go. What this shows is that valuations they're putting out on these companies make absolutely zero sense, particularly when you're in a down market and there's so many other bargain opportunities available. If you're putting out new paper that no one would pay for existing companies, what you're going to see is that after the initial pop, you're going to see a drop. So basically, the bankers have been in the desert for 18 months. Capital markets have been closed. Now they get a drink of water. And they try to take a Gatorade jug full of water. And what they should be doing is pricing these reasonably so that demand is excessive and the IPOs are successful so they can get dozens and dozens done before the end of the year. Instead, they're being pigs and they're gonna wind up with nothing if they don't change this pretty quickly. And I think the problem is it's like the real estate broker who wants the listing for your house, and you know it's worth $3.5 million and they say, oh, we'll get you $5 million. And you're like, oh, I'm going with this guy or gal. She's going to get me $5 million. It's only worth $3.5 million. And then when all is said and done, it turns out to be a flop and it takes longer than expected and they don't get the price. So, I think that the demand is there. There hasn't been supply. By the way, I picked up a little cold in Portugal, but feeling 100 times better. As a matter of fact, was supposed to be on Mornings with Maria this morning, thanks to JJ Smith. We rescheduled, but we'll be back in 100% form for next week. And so I think we're going to see this flow. I will say, you know, looking at today, okay, so now the future, now it's rebounding, but the market was down like, I don't know, 350 points for a minute because of a soft bond auction in the afternoon and the inflation numbers this morning. And I like that setup going into earnings. I do think the banks are going to be very interesting because on the one hand, I think they're going to be better than expected. On the other hand, I think they're going to start to take reserves, which is going to make people nervous. So we'll see the extent of the reserves that they take. I think people kind of know that's coming. It's just going to be the magnitude. But I do like offsides positioning. I do like pessimism. And I do like negative prints the day before earnings season start, especially when estimates are low, because this is going to be the next catalyst to the upside into year end. And no one's specifically looking for it. So as for Peter Lynch, and by the way, I will be on CNBC Indonesia, but remotely tomorrow. So hopefully my voice will hold up for that. But Peter Lynch, the most important organ in the body as far as the stock market is concerned is the guts, not the head. Anyone can acquire the know-how for analyzing stocks. And we've seen that this year. And I think it's going to serve us well as we look into the last few months of the year, how the tide changes and all that cash has to come in, and it has to come in all at once. And we'll talk about some of that. I like this from Seth Golden over on Twitter. He says, best returns have come from both very high and very low starting points for interest rates. The worst returns have come during average rate regimes. So if you look, because low rates equals high returns does not mean that high rates equals low returns. And that's counterintuitive when you think about the discount rate. But you also have to think about what's driving higher rates. And if it's above average growth, that's a healthy thing. I continue to point back to the late 90s when the Fed funds rate was pinned higher for longer at average about 6.1% for 5 years. And we had one of the biggest rallies in tech in the history of humankind. And that's why I continue to tell people, particularly last fall when everyone was in the bunker, keep an open mind, because yes, it's intuitive, but you're stuck in your recency bias from a once in 100-year position following the great financial crisis where rates were repressed. You want to see rates go higher because it means demand for capital, it means growth is picking up, it means all those good things are happening. So as we look at this chart, here we are in the 4 to 6% range. The average 1 year return since 1926 is 6.3%. So that's not ideal, but it's not terrible. It's positive. And then 5 years out, 34%. And then 10 years out, 77%. 20 years out, 420%. So above 8% is where, and in the 0 to 2% because you're in deflation, and in the 8% when you're out of control are those periods where you get the negative 1 year averages, which are bad situations. I think we're somewhere here, you know, in this range. I think we're going to get a lot into year end. And then I think next year is going to be more of a high single digit year than a, mid-teens year. I think we could finish out this year, if not closer to 20%, and really surprise everyone getting close to new highs. That's going to depend on earnings season, but I think that that could be in the cards. And that's what we're starting to be positioned for here. I think we're moving into, and this is something you're probably not going to hear anywhere else, an environment that is going to include yield curve control. So what is yield curve control? Put simply, this is from the Fed's website, St. Louis Fed. How does yield curve control work? Yield aims to control interest rates along the same portion of the yield curve. The yield curve is usually defined as the range of yields on treasury securities from 3-month treasury bills to 30-year treasury bonds. However, yield curve control targets longer term rates directly by imposing interest rate caps on particular maturities. Because bond prices and yields are inversely related, this also implies a price floor for targeted maturities. If bond prices, yields of targeted maturities remain above or below the floor, the central bank does nothing. However, if prices fall, yields rise above the floor, the central bank buys targeted maturity bonds, increasing the demand and thus the price of those bonds. So Japan's been doing this for a while. The US did it in the last time we had debt to GDP above 120%, which was 1942 to 1947. They did it for, you know, 5-6 years. And then once inflation started to run above trend, they were able to back out of that and inflate their way out of the debt problem, which is what I think we need to do here. And I think we will do. I think now, you know, yeah, we had a worse than expected PPI and CPI reports in the last 2 days. Although core today was fine, it was in line with expectations at 4.1. I think we're done with this. Still keep talking the 2% fantasy, but if we get to 2%, we're toast, because then our debt to GDP is probably going to go up to 130 or 140. If we can stay at this 3 to 4% range or 3 to 5% inflation for the next 3 to 5 years, we've got a good shot to bring down debt to GDP to 80% or even less, provided we have the nominal growth. And I think things are set up to actually make that happen based on demographics and a bunch of other things we look at. So how are they going to run inflation hot and roll all this debt and keep yields contained so that it doesn't collapse everything? And the only answer, and they don't want to do QE again, unlimited buying and printing more money. So yield curve control is the very way to do it. It's the threat more than the action. They don't have to be buying unlimited. The market just needs to know if the 10-year yield goes over 4.5 or 5.1 or whatever they decide is going to be the ceiling on yields or the floor in price, that they're going to step in. No one's going to bet against the wealthiest man in the world, which is Powell's ability to go in unlimited to defend those levels. And I think that's coming to a theater near you. And I think that's going to become a game changer in terms of people's comfort levels. Even if it's a level that's higher than here, let's say, you know, we got down to 5.8 and now today we spiked up because of the we got down to 4.56. Now we're at 4.7 again because of the inflation report. I think that even if their target was 5 or 5.2 or 4.7 or 4.5, who knows what it's going to be, once the world knows that that's the ceiling, then people can get on with stop worrying about rate of change, stop worrying about rates, stop worrying about hike or not hike, but they can actually plan, and that gives a lot of comfort and stability to business and the economy and refinancing and all the, and banks and everything, and then the game just goes on, and they'll keep pretending they're going to get 2%. They'll keep running inflation, you know, 3 to 5, and we'll bring that debt to GDP down, and everyone will look back, and all the bears in 5 years will say, oh my God, what happened? Like, we've got our deficit under control. Like, how did that happen? Well, it happened the same exact way it happened last time our deficit was out of control, control yields and inflated away. So that's, I think, an important concept to keep in the back of your head. We covered this, I think, last week. Global stocks are in oversold territory, so you can go back. This is where we get bounces. We know that. Average hourly earnings, this is more important than the headline CPI. Core was in line today. This was average hourly earnings last Friday. Continue to come down. That's the most important number in terms of avoiding a wage price spiral. So we like to see that. This is CTA positioning. Got to levels that you always get rip your face off. They were even more short than the COVID lows. So that's why you saw the big rally this week. And then today it took a little cool off. But I think as we get through into earnings season, we're going to see a reacceleration. All this wrong-sided positioning is going to get ripped right up to the top very, very quickly. Like this, Nelson Peltz took a 2.5 increase his position, I think 30 million shares, $2.5 billion position in Disney. So he's back in the game. That puts a put in the price. China's 8-day holiday season sees domestic tourism levels surpass 2019 levels. Housing industry urges Powell to stop raising interest rates or risk an economic hard landing. I think that's where yield curve control starts to come in. Fed minutes show some officials ready to pivot from how high to how long. I think they're basically done despite this inflation stuff. They'll keep threatening it to keep inflation expectations down. But once yield curve control goes into effect, I think you're going to see a completely different regime change in terms of sentiment and business moving forward. And if you're out before that happens, you're going to miss it. So here's Jay Capel over at Sentiment Trader talking about the seasonality of biotech. November is the strongest month of the year, so still positioned for that. And then he looks here, 3-day average of S&P stocks above the 50-day average, crossed above 22%, while the S&P greater than the 200-day moving average. Okay, so this is just a quantitative thing. It basically says good things are coming on average. So that's nice. Article of the week, let there be light, stock market and sentiment results. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw that light was good. Then he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day and the darkness night, and evening passed and morning came, marking the first day. With rates steadying and turning, we believe a new day has begun, despite today's counter trend here. And I think they're gonna put a cap on it, and the market is stiffing that out. As I said last week, it would either be done through organic demand or natural demand or unnatural intervention. I think we're going to get a combination of both. So last week we said the market always crashes when we go on vacation and that it would recover when we returned. That was true last week. It's been true so far this week. We'll see how things wind up. But I really do like this negativity into earnings season, which starts tomorrow. I know that's strange, but I've been doing this for a while. As we've repeated in recent weeks, the key to this market is rates. When rates stop going up, everything would begin to change for the better all at once. This week is showing what that looks like. We believe this turnaround is in the early stages. You can see all the instances of treasuries getting this oversold, greater than 2 standard deviations in the past 35 years, and how it played out. So I then put this bond chart up, and you can see in each instance pretty much to the tick, in some cases a little early, but bonds get bid, 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 bonds get bid in the short term. And I think now we're set up to get a more durable. This divergence finally played out. We had looked at it when it was at the double bottom and had the divergence. Now we have what is a proper divergence, where you make a lower low, while the RSI is making a higher low. That shows buying power into weakness, and that usually signals a turnaround. That's a positive thing. Same thing with the breaking this uptrend line on the 10-year yield. And then even the dollar started to cooperate, breaking this short-term counter trend of the last 11 weeks. By the way, relentless uptrend, and now it's broken the trend. So I think we're going to see a more subdued dollar, which will help a lot of our positions play out. Now, Fed and their whisperer at the Wall Street Journal are sending all the right signals. They've been out doing the tour this week, basically saying that the bond market is doing their work for them, and therefore they can probably continue the pause. November is pricing in, that's correct. December moved up from 30% to 33% this morning, which is kind of de minimis considering the report. But actually, what most analysts are saying is the housing data is going to kick in more pronounced in coming months. It will or it won't. I mean, this 3 to 5% range, if it bounces around here, I think they're done. And I think we do need to run inflation above trend. And I think this is a good range. So next, as far as Cooper Standard, a lot of production coming in order to normalize inventory levels. UAW appears to be taking desperate measures as their cash reserves are declining by the day. Sooner or later, the parties will come to a short-term agreement. Mexico will be the biggest beneficiary as more production is forced offshore to remain competitive with non-union producers. You know, we've done the math. Non-union, I think, are all in 45 an hour versus union at 55 to 65. Very, very tough to compete, or 65 is what they're asking. The UAW is effectively forcing the American consumer's hand to buy foreign and non-union vehicles as U.S. OEMs will no longer be able to compete on price. UAW will lose a lot of jobs over the next few years as a result of this Mexican standoff. Reasonable raises slash COLA adjustments are good. Obviously, people need more money with recent inflation, but inflation hasn't been 40%. So somewhere in the middle would be reasonable. That's what the OEMs have offered. Instead, they've been met with the Heisman saying, no, we want 40% raises for, 25% less work or something along those lines. And excess demands in exchange for less service provided rarely end well for any party involved. But here are the domestic auto inventories. This is, I think this was Steve Frampton that sent this over. Thanks for doing that. It's from Yardeni. Domestic auto inventories to sales. So you can see after every downturn, it gets really overshot to the downside. In 2001 and 2010, and even 2000 in 1991, all these recessions, you saw these drops. So they're at month supply. So they're at 1 month supply to sales, and they're ordinarily at 2.5 months. So they've got to basically increase their inventory by, 150% or 1.5 months in order to just be in line with normal, and 2 full months worth to get to like the peaks that usually happen after the recessions. And this was the same situation when Munger did the Tenneco trade, which was the model for our Cooper Standard trade. And when it accelerates, it starts to accelerate very quickly. And I think that will be the result. There'll be some concession when they come to an agreement about, more work. We'll give you more money. We want more work. And we'll see that production just absolutely accelerate. And I think that's going to be a good thing. And it's going to be a great thing for Cooper Standard with the operating leverage. So that's that. The other thing that I think is an opportunity here, trucks, you can see domestic light trucks are doing well and recovering nicely. But I think the opportunity here that people are underestimating is going to be domestic cars. And these things have been in gutter for a long time, and there's a lot of makeup work. So like I said, either the American OEMs are going to start to fill that demand, or the Kias and the Hyundais are going to come in and absolutely flood the market with it. Hopefully it's the former, but it may in fact be the latter. But you can see that this gap, just to become quasi-normalized, is just huge. So key concept I want to cover today is what happened to medical device companies yesterday, including Baxter. And just trying to see here. So you could see, so Novo Nordisk halted a trial of semaglutide versus placebo on the progression of renal impairment in people with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease early, because they were showing that it was effective, or they believed that it was effective, and that's going to prove to be the case. And what happened was, not just companies that had exposure to dialysis, but all medical device makers, and we saw in recent weeks the food companies like McDonald's, like Pepsi, like all these companies have just traded down because the market is extrapolating off of a few hundred thousand people who are using this, that the entire country is going to use this at $14,000 to $16,000 a year. Everyone's going to lose 10 pounds. There are going to be no side effects. And by the way, when they all get skinny, none of them are ever going to need a medical procedure again, nor are they going to eat fast food or candy or drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes. So we're going to take the other side on that. And I think it's creating an enormous amount of opportunities, some in Staples. And for some, it may be a little too early, but there are enough names now that have been punished enough that are starting to look extremely attractive, whether it's in medical devices. We own a small position in Baxter. We're thinking about even increasing that weight. We did at the margins yesterday in the flush, may do a little bit more. And I think there are a lot more. You know, I was looking at some of the liquor companies today. If you look at some of the Staples companies, obviously the soda companies, the McDonald's, et cetera, some of them had too high evaluations before this happened, so they may have to come down a little bit more and overshoot on the downside. But there's going to be a lot of great opportunity here. And this is what I live for, is these pockets of dislocation. And I think we're on to another one that may play out very, very nicely. So the dialysis market has been supported by high rates of obesity and diabetes, which contributed kidney damage. But GLP-1 drugs such as semaglutide have been shown to improve both conditions in trials. In the case of Baxter, the renal care business represents 25% of revenue. That's a significant slug. However, what is not advertised about that is that the vast majority of their renal care revenue is from outside the United States. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. So as much as I think analysts are overestimating the amount of people who will be covered and or be able to afford the GLP-1s in the U.S., the wealthiest nation in the world, the numbers are going to drop dramatically as you move abroad to where their actual renal care business is. And even if everyone that the analysts think can and will be able to use it does use it by 2030, there's a case to be made that it's actually going to increase the renal care business, because not all of the kidney dialysis business is exclusively a function of overweight and diabetes. And if the GLP-1s are as good as everyone thinks they are, with no side effects, then people are going to live a lot longer, which means they're going to use dialysis for many more years than expected. And it could actually be bullish for that business. But let's leave that aside for now. Baxter's already spinning out the renal care business to shareholders because it has a lower growth rate and a lower return on invested capital than the rest of its segments. This will be affected by July 2024. You can listen to the CEO talking about that here. As a matter of fact, go to the website, hedgefundtips.com. You'll find the article on the right-hand side here, Let There Be Light, under popular posts. You can also find all the ones we've ever done under commentary, under categories, and you can sign up to get our emails into your inbox right here, unsubscribe at any time. The optimistic side, I would listen to both of these. This is from healthcare conferences at Morgan Stanley and at Wells Fargo just a few weeks ago in September. The optimistic sell side estimates of GLP-1 coverage in the US by 2030 range between 7 to 9% of the population. So give or take a little less than from 20 to 30 million people. So far, however, more carriers have stopped covering GLP-1s versus started covering GLP-1s in the last year. Coverage for GLP-1 drugs has decreased by 50% since December 2022. Nearly 70% of insurance plans included in the study did not indicate coverage for GLP-1s, either for obesity or for diabetes treatment. Drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy are leading payers to look far more closely at prescriptions and deny coverage more frequently. GLP-1 coverage for patients declined from 27% in December 2022 to just 12% in June of 2023. From leaning more closely on their pharmacy benefit managers to outright dropping coverage options, as demand continues to grow, insurers' tolerance for the cost of these drugs is waning. The dynamics have changed. Next excerpt. Public and private insurers aren't convinced they're worth covering. They put weight loss in the same category as balding and erectile dysfunction. 3/4 of private insurers don't cover weight loss drugs either. Most state Medicaid programs for low-income and disabled veterans restrict coverage as well, with just 10 offering broad coverage. Coverage is also spotty in much of Europe and Canada. When insurers do pay, patients can face restrictions for how long they can take it or have to prove that they've tried other weight loss methods. So imagine incurring a $14,000 to $16,000 liability forever so that someone can fit into a size 6. Now, you'll say, no, it's not that. Some people aren't doing it. They're just doing it for health reasons. They're morbidly obese. And I think there will be some distinction in there where some will get covered, some won't, but it's not going to be everyone. And then people forget recent history. Weight loss drugs had a bad track record. The Fen-Phen craze in the late 90s imploded after one of its components was linked to heart valve damage. Over the next two decades, several other pills were recalled for safety reasons. Obesity drug development was a graveyard. You know, there's something about losing weight without doing any exercise or changing your diet that, you know, it's like when you do a mathematical equation, you know, inputs on one side equal the output on the other side. It's like if you just get the weight loss output, but you don't put any of the like change your diet, do exercise on the other side. Is it possible that this is the miracle that's going to do that without any side effects? You can have the free lunch. You can have your cake and eat it too. Maybe this will be the exception. I've not yet found it in life, but the market is convinced that that's going to be the case, and that's what's creating the opportunity and dislocation, whether it's McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Hershey's, Baxter, Medtronic, you name it. I think there's a tremendous amount of stuff to do out there. So GLPs do, including nausea, diarrhea, vomiting. We're talking about side effects now. The medication also lists a potential risk of thyroid cancer. So they don't have any long-term data on humans, but they do have some on rats. And what they found in rats is when they take it for a while, they get tumors on their thyroid. So whether that will translate to humans or not, we won't know until we know. So this trend can last longer than we expect. You know, until there is that pushback, there's something to be said for that. Now, are weight loss drugs safe? Other points we need to discuss. So they talk about stomach paralysis, thyroid cancer, some of these other things. I think the incidence of the stomach paralysis was like 5 to 8 in 1,000 on the most recent study. I'm cuffing that because I read a lot about this stuff over the last week, but it was de minimis for the time being, and that's a positive thing. That's in the short term. The thing that is interesting is, you know, Intuitive Surgical got hit because there's less bariatric surgeries. The interesting thing about the bariatric surgery is that only 1/4 of the people who do bariatric surgery experience. Let's see. Anyway, the point is that there are a good portion of people who do bariatric surgery that actually keep the weight off. Whereas with this, the second you stop using it and injecting yourself every week, and there will be oral versions that are easier and so on come down the pike, whether they'll be as efficacious or not remains to be seen. The minute you stop losing it, you gain the weight back. So basically, you're going to spend $14,000 to $16,000 a year for the rest of your life to maintain that weight. And that's what the studies say. What percentage of the population and or insurance coverage is that going to be sustainable for? You know, we don't know. Only 20 to 30% of privately insured patients have coverage on the drugs. Medicare doesn't cover it either. And that's that. So here's the data around stomach paralysis and pancreatitis. Here's the study from JAMA, J-A-M-A, the medical journal. And then finally, kidney dialysis disruption. Any shrinking of the kidney disease patient population may be 15 years in the future. This was from an analyst at Odo BHF. They argued that the new drugs could actually benefit dialysis providers in the short term by helping to ensure that those who start the treatment are already more closely monitored by doctors and less likely to die in the initial months of treatment. Here's an article from Barron's, Ozempic won't kill Americans' taste for sugary snacks because all these stocks sold off. Investors betting on the end of processed food are overlooking the vast uncertainties that lie between the current obesity drug landscape, where the number of patients on Wegovy in the US is in the quote, hundreds of thousands, and a theoretical future where nearly a quarter of American adults are on the drugs and lose their taste for products from snack food and behemoths like Coca-Cola. The estimate and others like it leaps over the enormous financial barriers that may make uptake of these medications by 50 million people or nearly 20% of the US adult population almost unthinkable. That's from Bank of America. Weight loss hype, drug hype looks overdone. In recent days, Wall Street analysts speculated that a world slimmed down by the so-called GLP-1 drugs would be bullish for airlines such as United Airlines, as lighter passengers save fuel, and bearish for restaurant plays such as software vendor Toast, as customers eat out less. Yes, the GLP trade seems overdone for now. That's the thinking of Jefferies analyst Matt Taylor, who upgraded his rating Monday on insulin pump maker Insulet, PODD. This one's been crushed from hold to buy, saying that the stock's 50%, he was a day early, but nonetheless, 50% drop since May, has trimmed its handsome valuation to levels that now account for GLP-1 impact on diabetes prevalence. He sees plenty of opportunity for Insulet and its pump rival Tandem, as well as for glucose monitor maker Dexcom, so he reiterated his buy ratings on the latter two names. The GLP-1 drop in medtech stocks is probably overdone, wrote Morgan Stanley analyst Patrick Wood in a recent note. This is very important. If as many as 30% of type 2 diabetes patients adopt GLP-1 drugs by 2027, Wood's modeling foresees just a 4% decline in those that need insulin. Still, he thinks it too early to upgrade his ratings on Dexcom and insulin from equal weight. So he's looking at his technical indicators before he pulls the trigger. But more likely than not, he's looking at price, and he will upgrade after the price goes up. Moving on. We have now officially entered Clown Town and Silly Season, as Mizuno analyst worries that GLP-1 drugs will become a drag on the restaurant industry. Longer term, we believe the rise of GLP-1 drugs such as Ozempic for type 2 diabetes and weight loss could lower restaurant spend. Here's an analyst from Jefferies saying airline's biggest expense is fuel. Quote, if every passenger just dropped 10 pounds, a carrier such as United could save 1,800 pounds per flight. That would save $80 million a year at current fuel prices and would boost United's earnings by 2% or 20 cents a share. He's also bearish, this analyst, on paper and packaging companies could see reduced demand from food service customers if GLP-1 curb America's appetite. The real issue analysts miss when they say, quote, if everyone just loses 10 pounds, American Airlines can earn another 20 cents per share, is who's going to pay the $14,000 to $16,000 per year so everyone can lose 10 pounds and we use less paper bags at McDonald's. Maybe you can get Cigna to pick up your $50 Thighmaster from Suzanne Summers, but they aren't going to pay $14,000 to $16,000 per year so you can fit into a size 6 or save your airline of choice a few bucks on fuel costs. Even for diabetics, the math is complicated. The estimated excess cost to insurers of a diabetic patient is about $9,600 a year. So they can pay $9,600 a year and know what they're getting into versus $16,000 per year and have no idea of the long-term side effects and additional costs. What do you think they're going to choose? I actually heard one analyst on TV say that McDonald's, quote, could still succeed if they get into the business of selling carrots and salads. He said this with a straight face. Where do they find these people? I have no idea, and you absolutely can't make this stuff up. So what about self-payers, you say? The top 10% of household incomes in the United States start at $191,406. That's probably around $110,000 after tax, depending where you live. Add a mortgage and property tax, and you're at $60,000 of disposable income. Are you spending $16,000 before you consider food, clothes, auto, insurance, kids, and other expenses? And that's on top of the 10% of the country, and that's the top 10% of the country, the 30 million people who have a lower propensity towards obesity and diabetes to start with. What about the remaining 90%? How's United Airlines ever going to save that 20 cents on fuel if we don't figure this out? The other point that few have noticed is that the majority of renal revenues for Baxter come from outside the U.S. Renal care in the U.S. is just 6% of total revenue. So, you know, here's a stock that's down some 50%. You know, part of the decline is obviously before this, but a good portion of the decline is a function of fears around this short-term mania. And at the end of the day, we're talking about 6%. If it went to zero, if this stuff was the greatest miracle since the wheel, the invention of the wheel, then you'd lose 6% of revenue. So while GLP-1 penetration in the U.S. is optimistically projected to hit just 7% of the U.S. population, wealthiest in the world, by 2030, according to Morgan Stanley this week, penetration outside the U.S. is much lower. So you can see the figures. U.S. renal care is de minimis relative to international. And if anywhere is going to get penetration in covering these, it's going to be the wealthiest nation in the world. And the jury's still out on that. Right now it's moving in the opposite direction. It'll take Mr. Market a while to figure this out and actually do the work and reverse this bipolar reaction to a news headline, which is why we only added at the margin to what is already a small weighted position in the portfolio. Even medical device makers that had no exposure to kidneys were slaughtered on the assumption that everyone will be skinny and never need another procedure at a hospital again. Last time I checked, there were a lot of hips, knees, shoulders getting done from pickleball, paddle, tennis, and golf. When people lose weight, they get active. Why weren't the sneaker stocks and airlines up on lower fuel costs if everyone is going to get skinny? As Buffett says, Mr. Market is kind of a drunken psycho. Some days he gets very enthused. Some days he gets very depressed. And he gets really, when he gets really enthused, you want to sell to him. When he gets really depressed, you want to buy from him. And there's no moral taint attached to doing that. And that's the master Warren Buffett. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing across these stocks as they relate to GLP-1s. Whether you're replacing a heart or a hip, you're still going to need a hospital bed, IV, syringe, and anesthesia. We may consider additional weighting with Baxter and other opportunities in the space while this dislocation is still available. What about safety? Novo Nordisk. The European Medical Agency ramped up scrutiny of GLP-1 treatments, raising a safety signal about potential risks that the diabetes and obesity drugs could cause cancer. The way they're trading, you would think they cured cancer. The drug already carries a boxed warning in the U.S. about the potential risk of users developing thyroid cancer. GLP-1 receptor agonists as a drug class have been used to treat type 2 diabetes for more than 15 years. Novo Nordisk added, here's what makes the least sense to me about yesterday's move. If GLP-1s have been used to treat type 2 diabetes, 95% of all diabetics, for 15 years, why are there still any dialysis or dialysis-related companies still in business today? In other words, it's new for weight loss. I understand that. That's okay. But those exact patients who require renal care today have been using GLP-1s for 15 years, and the dialysis business is still growing at 5% a year over those 15 years. The price response to the study results headline says one thing, but the fact that it's already been used for 15 years and there's still dialysis demand tells me everything I need to know. This is a nonsense noise reaction. What's next? Here's a mashup of the commentary after the bell. JP Morgan's analysts were the first one out with some semblance of rationality while most others were hiding under their desks. Here's a synopsis of JP Morgan's take, followed by a doctor's take, followed by a sell side analyst take. The most interesting takeaway was the CEO from Fresenius, which is the largest dialysis provider in the US. I think their stock was down 20% yesterday. He said the drugs will actually benefit dialysis providers as the patients will now live longer and need their services for longer than expected. There's a pony in this pile. The joke concerns twin boys of 5 or 6, worried that the boys had developed extreme personalities. One was a total pessimist, the other a total optimist. Their parents took them to a psychiatrist. By the way, this was one of Ronald Reagan's favorite jokes. First, the psychiatrist treated the pessimist. Trying to brighten his outlook, the psychiatrist took him to a room piled to the ceiling with brand new toys. But instead of yelping with delight, the little boy burst into tears. "What's the matter?" the psychiatrist asked, baffled. "Don't you want to play it with any of the toys?" "Yes," the boy bawled, "but if I did, I'd only break them." Next, the psychiatrist treated the optimist. Trying to dampen his outlook, the psychiatrist took him to a room piled to the ceiling with horse manure. Instead of wrinkling his nose in disgust, the optimist emitted the yelp of delight the psychiatrist had been hoping to hear from his brother, the pessimist. Then he clambered up to the top of the pile, dropped to his knees, and began gleefully digging out scoop after scoop with his bare hands. "What do you think you're doing?" the psychiatrist asked, just as baffled by the optimist as he had been by the pessimist. "With all the manure," the little boy replied, beaming, "there must be a pony in here somewhere." And that's exactly what we're seeing in the last few days with food stocks, medical device stocks, etc. I think that will prove to be the case with medical device companies following this abrupt reaction. There is a pony in this pile. Now on to the general market. Retail investors improved their sentiment a little bit this week, up to 40% bullish. But the fear and greed was 33, which is still showing a lot of fear in the market. And active investment managers still only had 36% exposure to equities, which means if earnings come in as well as I expect in coming weeks, there is going to be a chase among chases into year end, and equities are going to be forced higher. Basic material earnings in aggregate down 50 basis points at 85 basis points, so effectively flat over the last 60 days. And IBD top 50 growth companies, their estimates have risen 1.9% for this year and 2.81% for next year in the last 60 days. So estimates are going up in that group, which is good to see. And then here's the estimates going, most recent estimates going into earnings season is -0.3%. They've outperformed by 3 full percentage points the last few quarters. So we should see +3%, and people want to be in cash and negative ahead of that. Have at it, but they'll be chasing later is our general outlook. On to the data. As you can see here, it was the, obviously energy had an impact on headline, but when you look at core, it was down from 4.3 down to 4.1, and that was right in line with expectations, and that's what the Fed is looking at. So let's get to the Ask Me Anything questions for this week. The first one comes from Kayla Smith. Hi, Tom, what are your thoughts on Spirit AeroSystems? It's aerospace parts manufacturing and looks like it took a huge haircut over recent unprofitability problems and losses. They recently installed a new CEO. I feel this rhymes with Cooper Standard and Rolls-Royce. Problems of being priced for bankruptcy due to external factors, but once they get through it, could be a bagger. Love to hear what you think. I've been looking at this one. We haven't done anything. So I like your thought process. I usually like to have only one problem child fixer-upper per portfolio. But I do think you're spot on. This was the company, by the way, that messed up things for Boeing, which made Boeing sell off in the last few weeks. And I think she's spot on, because actually what's happening is their clients are forwarding the money because they need them to stay in business and provide those fuselages for them, among other parts. So I think you're spot on. Let's just take a look at their historic financials that don't include the fuselage issues. And it looks like they ran into some problems during COVID. Let's see here. Here we go. Ticker. It's basically our same thesis. So their OEMs, I guess, if you want to put it that way, are financing them this time because they need them to stay in business because their demand is unlimited. That's what's different about the auto business today than 2009. So in 2001, they kept their suppliers in business because they had the demand. In 2009, the OEMs themselves went bankrupt, so there was no reason to keep their suppliers in business. And this time, that's why Cooper Standard has been able to get so many pricing concessions, is because the OEMs need them to stay in business to meet the last 2 years of pent-up demand. As we saw earlier with the inventory levels are still at anemic levels. They're going to have to build that back up. So I like that scenario for Spirit AeroSystems. Let's just take a look and see if it's a decent business or if it's more of a trade. So it's kind of, it had a little rough patch. It looks like it's recovering. It's been losing money the last 3 years. That's never a great situation. I don't love that. And then you've got their cash dwindled a little bit. Get this thing out of here. They still got about $500 million, which is good. What does their debt look like in terms of refinancing? $3 billion. Cash flow. So since basically the pandemic, they've been burning cash. It seems to be getting less bad. Cash from operations, what have they been doing? They brought CapEx down a little bit. They issued some debt, they repaid some debt. So they refinanced some debt in 2020, which is good. 2021 and 2022. Yeah, so you just have this situation. This is a little bit hairier. It's historically been an okay business. I think it's worth doing more work on. I think you have to manage your risk on this one by your sizing. So you're not going to take a 10% position in something like this, but I do think this one's probably going to work out for you because you can't create competition for this type of part supplier overnight. And as a result, I'd be, you know, where we are in the cycle, what's the reason we own Rolls-Royce, for much lower levels, I think this one's going to get a tailwind. And if it does, you know, you could be looking at a, you know, three bagger plus over the next 3 to 5 years. But you're going to have to keep an eye on that cash flow and the balance sheet and get a better understanding of that before you lean in. So good work. Troy Sai asked, big fan of your videos. Like to get your take on Baxter. So yeah, you know our position there. We have a small position. We're probably going to be increasing the weight during this dislocation. And great minds think alike. Stephen Frampton, have you ever read Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow by Daniel Kahneman? Some of the chapters are incredibly pertinent to investing. For example, I just read a chapter on risk, and he basically said a basket of uncorrelated, reasonably sized, asymmetric risks should be accepted every time. I heard a lot of you in the book, but in different words. I have read the book. I've always done this intuitively. I've thought, for me, in order for me to put a dollar of capital at risk, it's got to earn for me. It has to have a possibility of being a double or triple in a reasonable amount of time. And it has to be a durable kind of proven business where I'm not trying to predict the future and hoping for the best. And if I can put 8 to 12 of those together that are reasonably uncorrelated, or we're going to win over time. And that's exactly what we do. I don't recall it coming from Daniel Kahneman. I think it just comes from experience and understanding the math of what out, you know, how you can get outperformance. I haven't seen many managers with more than 13, 14, 15 stocks be able to outperform over time. It's very, very rare. And you know, 99% of managers have more than that. Buffett's even narrowed it. I think Buffett or Munger talked about 3 to 5 is plenty. That's a little bit too concentrated for my liking because I always live in the world that there could be something that you don't know that you don't know, or something that changes that you couldn't possibly understand, which was kind of the feeling last morning, yesterday morning with Baxter. But when you step back and you actually did the work and you say, okay, this is what the market is thinking is possible in the best case of all worlds, and that's how the market's pricing, but the reality is more likely 10% of what they're expecting, in which case all these businesses are great and excessively too cheap relative to what they're going to be earning moving forward. And I think we're going to get a lot more color from that in coming weeks as they all start to deliver earnings. Anurag Gupta says, hope you had a great week, Tom. Was wondering if you like Target at these 110 levels. Thanks for taking my question. So we've covered Target a few times, and Target continues to come across my radar. I'm not ready for Target yet, and I don't think Target cares, but, you know, some of these things, everyone can do the math, everyone can have their framework for how do they invest, but the intangible is the experience you pick up and the intuition you pick up after doing something for a very long time. And I'm sure any good tennis player or golfer will say that you just need the years of experience. You need the time to, you know, it's something that just comes to you over a lot of time. I mean, as I look at this business right now, it's a great quality business. The valuation has come down, but it's in line with its historic multiple. I need a larger margin of safety before I would step into something like this. I think if you step in here, it's probably going to work. For me, it's just not a certainty. It's a probably, and I need something closer to a certainty, because when I have something close to a certainty, yes, new information could come that I didn't know that I didn't know, and it could change everything, which is why we never put 100% of our capital in one stock, or even 50% of our capital in one stock. But just taking a look at some of these data points here. I mean, yeah, so they had negative free cash flow last year. That was attributable to... pretty big CapEx. Change in accounts payable. Anyway, but it's still a compounder. It's still a decent business. I would want to own this at some point. I probably want to own it well below 100. I don't think I'll get that opportunity. So for me, if it's not, you know, I wait for the soft pitch right down the middle. So at this point, there's not enough margin of safety in it for me. I think you're getting a great business at a reasonable price, but it's just not, it's not right down the middle for me at the moment and at the valuation. I also don't like how they've handled this slippage issue. I know it's complicated, but I can tell you, if I owned five stores, we'd have zero slippage. We would find a clear way that there would be no slippage one way or another. And that would be without locking up every item under the sun and making the consumer experience be terrible. But that's just me. All right. Here's from Tim Cowan. Was wondering your view on Assertio Holdings, small cap biotech. So I read everything that you said. It's probably okay in terms of the work that you've done here. We'll never invest in an individual biotech because the exception would be like a huge company like a Biogen or maybe a Gilead or a Regeneron that are super duper established. But we view the biotech sector as deals and drugs, and you can't time the drug approvals and you can't time the deals. But when you buy a basket of them at the right point in the cycle, when they're beaten down, like they've been for the last year and a half, and nothing has dramatically changed, I'm sure there's a little more now. No one's going to need any drugs because everyone's going to be skinny and no one's ever going to get sick again in the market right now. But you know, when you get them at these beat down levels before they have parabolic moves and beat down levels before they have parabolic moves, eventually good things happen. So the group bottomed last May, went sideways, and it's been weak, and now we're moving into a seasonably strong point of the year. What's going to be the catalyst? We don't know. But as far as Assertio, we would never take that gamble on a small cap hoping for some approval or hoping for some deal, because the way to play it, in our view, is in a basket. John Burry, could you please cover BTI stock, British American Tobacco, in your next hedge fund tip to YouTube video? Great balance sheet, very undervalued with a reliable 9% dividend yield. Would you buy at these prices? Let's take a look. These have come down a little bit because after everyone loses 10 pounds and saves McDonald's all the paper bags and United all the fuel costs, they're never going to drink, smoke, or eat again. And I'll take the other side of that. I think that BTI probably hasn't come down enough yet, but it's close enough for government work. And the business, as you said, is a consistent earner. Cash flow per share continues to climb. Earnings per share. And you know what these things are is annuities. And having been in Europe, people are still smoking cigarettes, which is mind-boggling to me. They buy in the shares, they have steady cash flows, it's kind of an annuity, they pay out the dividends, they have decent balance sheets, low growth, but probably steady. I'd say it's probably better than a treasury bill. So you're going to get the dividend, you might get some capital appreciation of 50, 60, 70% over the next 3, 4, 5 years. And Live Another Day. So I think that's pretty decent. Let me just see if I'm missing anything here in the financials that would alarm me. TI. There it is. Yeah, steady as she goes. Cash machine. ~35% free cash flow margin. Revenues keep growing. Balance sheets. Plenty of cash. I think you're in pretty good shape, my friend. So if you like a slow, steady grower, I mean, what are the secular trends? You know what the secular trends are. They're not good, but it's come in a bit that you're probably okay. And you get a nice, get paid in a pretty nice dividend to wait. So I think you're okay. As always, this is all opinion, not advice. We don't know your financial situation. Get with your own financial advisor. We deal with accredited investors and qualified institutions only. Click on terms at hedgefundtips.com. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. Not just recovered from our